The Torah portion this week is called Chukat, and it comes from the book of Numbers. And in that Torah portion, we find the story of the red heifer and Moses striking the rock instead of speaking to it and being denied entrance into the promised land. And also, we see a battle between Israel and the Amorites. And so in ancient times, as the sages looked at this, they looked to the rest of the scriptures and thought, what is the passage of scripture that would go along with this section from the Torah? And they settled on the book of Judges, chapter 11, the story of Jephthah. In Hebrew, his name is pronounced Yiftach, which sounds kind of odd, but we'll just stick with Jephthah this morning. Now, the reason they chose this is because this battle in Numbers chapter 21 between Israel and our Amorites, now 300 plus years later, they revisit this because another battle ensues because of that battle so long ago. And so let's just jump right in to the study. Judges chapter 11. Now, I want to tell you that right up front, when you read about Jephthah, he is a mixed bag. And if you look at the first verse of chapter 11, this is what it says. Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor. And he was the son of a harlot. Right there, when we see Jephthah's name mentioned, we find out about his dual nature. In a lot of ways, Jephthah is like us because we have a dual nature. We have this capacity to be a mighty man, a mighty woman of valor. But we also have this problem because we're born into a world and with a yetzer hara, an evil inclination, we tend to mess up. I look back at my notes from 9 years ago, the last time we went through the Haftorah portions, and I had a laugh because I had two slides prepared about Jephthah. And the one slide was called Jephthah, a picture of Messiah. And I had all these things there listed about how, in many ways, Jephthah's life parallels that of Messiah. There are many similarities. But the other slide was titled Jephthah, a picture of a mess. Because his life was a mess. And he made wise decisions. He made foolish decisions. He did great things and caused great joy and rejoicing. He did dumb things that caused a lot of grief and heartache. And you find these two things in conflict. And we like our stories nice, neat, clean. We want to know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. But this is one of those guys. He's like us. He's got some of both. And so, as we read on through here, it says, Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot. Out of the 17 judges in the book of Judges, Samuel is considered to be the greatest, according to the Talmud. Jephthah is considered to be the least. Verse 2, Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when the wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah away and said to him, you will not inherit in the household of our father, for you are the son of another woman, a Zona, a harlot. Jephthah fled because of his brothers and settled in the land of Tov. Now, what does the word Tov mean, the Hebrew word Tov? Good. Mazel Tov, okay? Good fortune. And we say Boker Tov, good morning, or Laila Tov, good evening. Tov is good. He settled in the land called Good. But boorish men collected around Jephthah and ventured forth with him. One of the lessons that's brought out by this is found in the Talmud. It says, the world exists only on account of one who muzzles himself at a time of provocation. I'm not very good at muzzling myself when I'm provoked. I don't know about you. But one who muzzles himself at a time of provocation and refrains from acting. And the sages say this is why Jephthah found himself in the land of Good. Because he didn't argue with his brothers. He didn't fight back with them. He was being grossly mistreated. It was not Jephthah's fault that he was the son of a harlot woman, whereas his other brothers were all legitimate from Gilead's wife. It wasn't his fault. But he was terribly mistreated. And it says boorish men. And in the Hebrew it says anashim rekim. Anashim is men. Rekim means empty. This word rekim comes from the word raka. And that word is found in the New Testament in Matthew 5:22, where Yeshua says, and whoever says raka will be liable to the Gehenna of fire. You look at your brother, your sister, you say, empty, worthless. You say, when you do that and you make that decree on your brother or sister, what happens? You decrease your own worth and you become like a piece of trash that deserves to be thrown on the trash heap. Gehenna was the trash heap where the trash is always burned. And he says, this is something you're putting yourself in danger for. God says, I have no use for someone who tells people that they are of no use. And so we need to be very careful about that. Now, as we go through the story of Jephthah, there are three lessons, three important lessons, lessons you normally wouldn't hear taught from the scriptures, but they're hidden here, they're found here in this chapter. But they're very, very important principles, and I hope you'll take them to heart. And they're principles I have found to be true in my own life, and if I can remember to practice them, they always hold strong, hold true. So let's pick it up in verse 4 and read through verse 11. It says, it happened after a period of time. Now remember, Jephthah's driven out because he's the son of a harlot and his brothers don't want him. He's kind of a second rate. So they drive him out and he goes off with these boorish men, these Anashim Rekim. But it happened after a period of time that the children of Ammon made war with Israel. And it happened when the children of Ammon waged war against Israel that the elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah back from the land of Tov. They said to Jephthah, come and be our chief, and we will do battle with the children of Ammon. Ah, now when they need somebody who's a warrior and has Jephthah's skills, they have to kind of come dragging themselves back and asking pretty please to come and lead them and defend them. And they said, we'll make you our chief. A chief is a kind of a military term. It'd be like our general to lead us in battle. But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, was it not you who hated me and drove me away from my father's house? Do you see the picture of Yeshua here? How he's rejected by his brothers? He goes and lives among the likes of us Gentiles. He has an appeal to us. But the time's coming, will he be asked back? People have to repent how they've treated him, and will call him back. So was it not you who hated me and drove me away from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you are in distress? The elders of the Gilead said to Jephthah, for this have we now returned to you, that you go with us and do battle with the children of Ammon, and that you become, and this time they don't say a chief, this time they say a leader, a rosh, a head, a leader over us, over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you bring me back to do battle with the children of Ammon, and Adonai delivers them before me, I'll become your leader, your head. Then the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, may Adonai bear witness between us if we do not do according to your word. So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and his people set him as a leader and a chief over them. You know, sometimes we want Messiah to be our chief, to go do battle for us in a particular situation. He says, no, I'm not your chief unless I'm also your head. In other words, I don't come in just to be played general when you're in a problem. I'm your head, which means I'm king over you all the time. And sometimes we just want a part-time Messiah, but there's no such thing. He's either our full-time Savior and Lord, or he's not our Savior and Lord. And he's not one we just recruit when we need him. We are to submit our lives to him every day. Jephthah spoke all his words before Adonai in Mizpah. So what's the backstory to this? Here's the backstory. Back in Genesis, we see Abraham and his nephew Lot. And they come out of the land of Ur, and they come into Canaan. And as you know, Lot, Abraham's nephew, his sheep and herds were so large, and Abraham's are so large, that the shepherds of Abraham and the shepherds of Lot began to butt heads. They realized we were going to split up, we're too big to kind of move around and occupy the same area. So Abraham said, okay, Lot, well, you pick. If you go north, I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north. Lot says, I'm going to go east. And he saw Sodom, and he went east, down into Sodom. Bad choice. And so when Lot got down there, you know the story of the messengers who came and visited Abraham, and they came to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham pled with them and said, if you find 10 righteous souls, are you spared? They said, we'll spare it for 10. Couldn't find 10. The best they could do were 4, Lot and his wife and their 2 daughters, and they were kind of iffy. And but the angel said, I can't destroy this until you're out of here. So they bring him out and said, you go over there. And they said, oh, that's too far. We don't like that. Can we go over here instead? Lot always had another better idea. And so they went to this other place, went to a cave. Remember, Lot's wife turned around, looked at Sodom. She's warned not to, and she turned into a pillar of salt. So now we're from 4 down to 3. So Lot and his 2 daughters are in the cave. The 2 daughters, as far as they know, the whole world's destroyed. They're not going to have any children, so they come up with this cunning plan. The first daughter gets her father, Lot, drunk, sleeps with him, becomes pregnant, and has a son whose name is Moab, which means Mo from Av, father, Moab. Can you imagine being Moab? Moab, how'd you get your name? Well, the next night, the younger sister gets Lot drunk, sleeps with him. She becomes pregnant. She has a son. She names him Ammon. It comes from the word Am, which means people. We're not sure what the own at the end means. It might mean great people or many people or lots of people. But it has to do with people. And this is where the problem comes in. The Ammonites all descend from Lot's son through his younger daughter. So, fast forward. Israel comes out of Egypt, right? And they wander around for 40 years, and now it's time to go into Canaan. Only problem is they come up to the Jordan River, there are all these nations who are camped over on the east side of the Jordan River. The first nation they come to is Edom. God says, you can't attack Edom. You can ask permission to go through. They did. Edom says, no way. You try coming through here, we're going to kill you. And God says, you don't fight Edom. Why? Because Edom is Esau. These are descendants of Esau. Esau is Jacob's brother. The Edomites are all cousins of the Israelites. God says, don't attack them. So they move up a little bit. They come to Moab. God says, don't attack Moab. Those are your cousins. And then they went up a little further. And that is where the land of the Ammonites used to be, but the Ammonites have been conquered by the Amorites. So let's make sure we get the picture. Ammon had been attacked by the Amorites, and there was no block against attacking the Amorites. This is a Canaanite nation. They're a wicked people, so Israel attacks them. This is all in Numbers chapter 21 in our Torah portion. And Israel destroys the Amorites and settles in their land. So fast forward 300 plus years, 300 years after Israel has settled in this land, some of the Ammonites come back and say, we're going to kill you. We want our land back. Even though they had been defeated by the Amorites and Israel had conquered the Amorites, the Ammonites now want their land back from Israel, 300 years later. And this is the argument that's going on as you go into the next page. So I wanted to give you the backstory so you'll understand this next section. So starting with verse 12. Jephthah sent emissaries to the king of the children of Ammon, saying, what is there between you and me? In Hebrew, it's maliv alak. We're going to come back and revisit that question because as far as I can tell, that question is asked more than any other question in the Bible. 7 times you find it in the scriptures. 4 times in the Hebrew scriptures, 3 times in the Gospels. We're going to come back to that. It's a powerful question. What is there between you and me that you have come to me to make war in my land? Emphasis on my land. This land belongs to the Israelites. The king of the children of Ammon said to Jephthah's emissaries, because Israel took away my land when it ascended from Egypt, from Arnon to the Jabbok to the Jordan. So now return them in peace, 300 plus years later. Jephthah once again sent emissaries to the king of the children of Ammon and said to him, so said Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab and the land of the children of Ammon. For when they ascended from Egypt, Israel went in the wilderness until the Sea of Reeds, and then they arrived at Kadesh. Israel sent emissaries to the king of Edom, saying, let me now pass through your land. But the king of Edom did not take heed. It sent also the king of Moab, but he was not willing. So Israel dwelt in Kadesh. They went through the wilderness and went around the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and came to the land of Moab from the east, where they encamped across the Arnon. But they did not enter the border of Moab, for the Arnon is the border of Moab. Then Israel sent emissaries to Sihon, king of the Amorite, the king of the Heshbon, and Israel said to him, let us now pass through your land until my place. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his border. Rather, Sihon assembled his entire people, and they encamped at Jahaz, and he made war against Israel. The Adonai, God of Israel, delivered Sihon and his entire people into the hand of Israel, and they struck them down. Israel took possession of the entire land of the Amorite, the inhabitants of that land. They took possession of the entire territory of the Amorite, from Arnon to the Jabbok, and from the wilderness to the Jordan. In other words, it wasn't your land. It had been lost to the Amorites. Amorites attacked us, we defeated them, and we took their land. They had taken it from you, but it's ours now. There's an extremely, extremely, extremely important lesson here. This is lesson number one I want you to pick up. Expect your defeated enemy, whatever it is, and however long it's been, to strike one last time. Now, over the years, Robin and I have had some interesting experiences with friends and loved ones who have gotten a victory over some stronghold in their life, and I've experienced it in my own life, too. And the victory might be over some addiction. It might be victory over some bad habit, some character flaw, whatever it is. You just think in your own life, what is the thing I've wrestled with and I've conquered it. I've got it. And we've observed, and I even said to her, you know, we've talked about how successful some of our friends have been in conquering things. I'll say, but you wait. Somewhere down the road, this thing will raise its ugly head. This thing we think is dead and buried, it'll come back, it'll attack one last time. And lo and behold, it always, always does. Every stinking time. After a time of being dormant, it'll come back for one last attempt. Don't be shocked if something you've conquered in your life, after a long period of time, comes back, and it comes back on steroids. And you think, was nothing accomplished? Here it is again. This is what happened here. This enemy of Israel, after 300 years, says, we're going to attack you. We're going to take our land back. Now, this principle is found in other places in Scripture, but I'm going to jump to one of the biggest examples. In Revelation, near the book of Revelation, Yeshua comes back, establishes his kingdom. There's peace everywhere. The lion lies down with the lamb. The lion eats grass like an ox does. The child can play on the hole of the venomous serpent. And people live for centuries. It's wonderful. And it says, and they will reign with him, that's with Messiah, for 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are the four corners of the earth. And there's one last big blowout battle. There's just this principle. I don't know why, but it is a principle that is found in the Word and it's found practically in life. So, here's the value of this lesson. You take that thing you've conquered and enjoy the peace and the victory. But when it comes back, and comes back powerfully into your life, don't be blown away. You should have been expecting it. Be prepared for it. It doesn't mean that you've lost ground. Doesn't mean that everything you accomplished in the past was a waste. That's not what it means. It's just the tactic of the enemy, and it's something that also God allows for whatever reason. I don't know. Maybe it's so we don't get complacent. Maybe it's so we begin to realize that everything depends on Him. And you can't just get overconfident that things are done. He wants us to stay on our toes. I don't know. But in His wisdom, this is a principle, and this is an important lesson to learn. And I think if we learn it, we'll be prepared for it. We won't be taken by surprise when this happens in our lives or in the life of someone we love. All right? Now let's go back and revisit that question. Now, I could be wrong, but as I've just explored my own mind and gone through, I can't find a question that's asked more often than this one. But you might find one. But this one's asked 7 times in the Scriptures. And this is what it looks like in Hebrew. Mali v'lach. It's only 3 words. It takes about 7 words in English to translate. But I love the way some of the translations render this. I have a few of them here. Mine says, what is there between you and me? But the New American Standard says, what is between you and me? The New English Translation, why have you come against me to attack my land? Which has really taken a free hand. I've gotten very disillusioned with the New English Translation. The Darby Translation, what hast thou to do with me? King James, what hast thou to do with me? My favorite is the Complete Jewish Bible. What's your problem? You can't beat that. And see, but this is one of those places where a translator has to throw up their hands because there's no way to bring this over into the English and keep it accurate without it just sounding weird. Here's how the Hebrew works, all right? The word ma means what? It's an interrogative. What? Question mark. Okay? That one's easy. Now, this next word is made of 2 letters. The lamed, which is this real tall letter here, when it's stuck to the front word, means to or toward. And then the yud at the back makes it first person, me. So, to me. And so, if we take the word li, it means to me. To me. Some of you have a wedding ring with a Hebrew inscription on it from the Song of Songs. Ani ledodi vedodi li. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, or is to me. Okay? Li. So that's what that means. Now, this last word, you see the lamed there again, which means to or toward, all right, in the middle. And then the vav at the front, whenever a vav is stuck on the front of the word, it means and. There is no Hebrew word for and. You just stick a vav on the front. The word vav means hook. And when you put the hook on the front of the word, it hooks it to the word before. It means and. So you got vav, which means and, the lam, which means to, and then the kaf at the end means you. So basically you have a bunch of prefixes and the suffix strung together means and to you. Now how do you translate that in English? What to me and to you? That is how it's translated. That's the literal translation. You can't do that in an English translation. So they render it all these various different ways. Oops. They render it in all these ways, but this is literally what it is. What to me and to you. Now, the word is would help, and there are Hebrew words that mean am or are, is, or will be, but usually they're not put into the Hebrew unless they're absolutely necessary or put in for emphasis. Normally, you just kind of interpolate that it belongs there. So we can put the word is in there. So what is it to me? And what is it to you? What is it to me and to you? And this is asked 7 times in the Scripture. Sometimes it's asked of God or his prophet toward a human being. Sometimes from a human being towards God or his representative. Sometimes it's just one man to another, like here in Judges. In Mark and in Luke, we find two accounts of the demoniac, which comes to Yeshua. He comes running to him, throws himself down, Malivalak. What is it to me and to you? And then we see Yeshua ask it of his mother at Canaan in John chapter 2. The wedding feast, they've run out of wine. Mary comes running to Yeshua. They're out of wine. And he says, Malivalak, Isha. What is it to me and to you, woman? What does this question mean? Why is it asked so often? And you may say, well, wait a minute. The New Testament's written in Greek. You know, it's not Hebrew. So how can you say it's the same question? Well, look at the Greek. T means what? Emoi means to me. And Greek does have a word for and. It's the word kai. And soi means to you. The oi at the end makes it dative, means to or toward. It works like the lamed in Hebrew. It even sounds similar. It has the same kind of rhythm. In Hebrew, mali valak. And in Greek, ti emoi kai soi. It means exactly the same thing. And this is something we find often in Greek. You find Hebrew phrases and idioms just carried over exactly into Greek, and you know that the people are speaking Hebrew, because this would be a very well-known Hebrew question. What's going on? How do we use this? So what's the lesson to be found here? And this leads us to our second lesson, and it is this. We all the time are running up to some concern. The box with the question mark in it means a concern you have in your life. There's always something. Always something. And here you are. And you're viewing this concern through your own physicality, through your own human reasoning. And we ask the question, Mali, what is this thing to me? Now, that sounds like it'd be an easy question to answer. What is this thing to me? But often it's not easy to answer because you don't really know what it is to you. It's like the 16-year-old kid who gets his driver's license. He needs a car. And so right away, he starts looking at Corvettes and BMWs and Porsches, and he's determined he's going to get one of these. And Dad says, what are you getting that for? I have to have a car. Well, here's a car over here for $50. Oh, no. And the kid can't understand what's involved, why it has to be this expensive sports car. Because he can't see how much of his own ego is invested in this decision. He can't see the expense it's going to be down the road. He's not going to see how he's going to be flat broke. He can't see the insurance, the gas, and everything. He can't see all of that. He can't answer the question, what is it to me? Now, if he's wise, he can. If the adult helps him walk through this, he'll be able to answer, I'm really overshooting the goal here. He realizes he's not looking for transportation. He's looking to make an impression. Okay? So one of the most important things we do is, first of all, when you look at a concern, to truly analyze, what is this thing to me? You know, in English, when you say, what's it to me? You mean it doesn't mean anything to me. It's none of my business. Or we'll say, what's it to you? Which means it's none of your business. But this question is a question that's profound. What is it to me and to you? Mali valak. Now, on the other side of this concern is always God's, his viewpoint. Now, we call his viewpoint truth. And he always views things from the viewpoint of absolute, total truth. And so when we ask, what is this thing to me, we must always ask, what is it to you? And God will ask us, what is it to me? And then what is it to you? And if we can answer these questions accurately, what we'll often find ourselves doing is coming and moving over to this side of the concern and standing shoulder to shoulder with truth. And that's what this question is for. Each of the times I found this question asked, there's always one person who's viewing something through human reasoning, and then the other person is viewing it from God's point of view, right? In all seven cases. Sometimes it's the person from human reasoning who asks the question. Sometimes it's the person from God's point of view asking the question. But the question needs to be asked. It's a question we need to be asking, and it's a question God is constantly asking us. The last time this question is found, as I mentioned, is in John. And I think there's a lot we can learn from this. Mary comes running to Yeshua. They're out of wine. This is a tragedy at a Jewish wedding, especially in the first century, the way it's all set up. It's an embarrassment. It's something that just puts a whole damper on the whole wedding feast. And see, she comes to her son. And he says, "Ma leva lach, woman. My hour is not yet come," but a better translation is this. Yeshua said to her, "Ma leva lach, woman. Has my hour not now come?" This is the translation that makes sense. And I don't care how you slice it and dice it, that first translation simply does not make sense. Never has, never will. When we look at the correct translation, which is the second one, we can begin to see Mary's viewpoint, Yeshua's viewpoint, and then what Mary says next, which is brilliant and wise. Here's Mary. Obviously, they're at this wedding because it's one of Mary's friends, a close friend she loves. And she wants everything to be just right, like you ladies do. I know when someone gets married or some special event, you ladies kind of come together. You just want to make it fly. You do a beautiful job, and you're conscientious, and everything is just perfect. Mary is the same way. But something tragic has happened. They're out of wine. Who knows? Maybe one of the wine vessels broke and got spilled. Maybe it didn't arrive in time. We don't know, but they don't have wine. And in a Jewish culture, and especially the ancient Jewish culture, wine isn't just a beverage. Wine is something special. It's something that has even a spiritual nature to it. And so many of the Torah observances, the welcoming of the Shabbat and so on, involves a glass of wine. Even the marriage ceremony, the two cups of wine, the Passover Seder, there are four cups of wine. Yeshua, he refers to these last two cups of wine, the cup of salvation and then the cup of praise. And he gives significance to each one of these. The cup of redemption right after the meal, he says, "Take and drink it. This is my blood of the new covenant." But then the last cup, which is called the cup of the kingdom, he says, "I will not drink this cup with you again until I drink it in my Father's kingdom." And these two cups find their way into the marriage ceremony. The first cup is the cup that brings the covenant of marriage to the point where they're ready to enter into cohabitation. And then the last cup, the moment they drink of that, they're married. And Yeshua says, this last cup, you know, you're betrothed to me, but we drink it together in my kingdom, and they'll be together forever. They cohabit. But wine is special. It's something, it's not just wasted. It's not something used for alcoholism. It's something that is elevated and very special. So at this wedding, you run out of wine. This is a disaster. So Mary, in her human concern, runs to her son. Now, he hasn't worked any miracles yet. He's not a miracle worker yet. And whether Mary knew that he could work miracles, I'm sure she knew he would because she knew he was the Messiah. But so far, he's just been at home, and he's been being either a carpenter or stonemason or both. And he's been taking care of his mom and the household and just growing and being this godly young man. She comes to him. They're out of wine. I don't know if she's expecting to do anything, but just, what do we do? And so he answers her, "What's this to me? And what is it to you?" And she had to stop and think. She knew what it was to her. It's a disaster. But what is this to Yeshua? And he gives her a hint. He says, has my hour not now come? And she realizes, oh, what looks like a disaster from my point of view is the door of opportunity where my son begins to step out and reveal to the world who he is. This isn't a disaster. This is perfect. This is God's plan. God's running the world. He hasn't blinked. Everything's on schedule. And the next thing she says is beautiful. She turns to the servants and says, whatever he tells you, you do it. She stepped aside with her worry, with her concern, with her human reasoning, and she saw what it was to Yeshua. Then all of a sudden her fears are put to rest. And this is his very first miracle. You know, Moses' first plague that he brings upon Egypt is turn the water into blood. You know, which is a terrible thing for Egypt, turns the Nile River to blood. But Yeshua steps in and he turns water into wine, something for celebration, something for covenant purpose. And what an amazing, amazing story. There's so much going on here. But this is lesson number two I want us to gather. And I worded this over and over and over and finally settled on this, and it's probably still not the best way. I just said, learn to see with both eyes. God made us in his image. He gave us two eyes, the left eye and the right eye. And you can see with either one, but with the two you see depth. You get perspective. And remember, the left is the physical, the right is the spiritual. Everywhere you find left or right in the Bible, the left is physical, right is spiritual. The key to this is Ecclesiastes, where it says, the heart of the fool is to the left, the heart of the wise is to the right. Right? And everywhere you find left and right, it's physical, spiritual. Not bad and good, just physical. Two different realms. And we as human beings, we stand at the place where the two meet. In us, the spiritual and the physical begin to knit back together. We have a foot in both. We're amphibians. But so many times we're just blind in our right eye. We see things only through the eyes of the flesh, only through the eyes of human reasoning. And the greatest enemy of faith is human reasoning. Now, the left eye is important. We need to see things physically as they are. But we must learn to see things spiritually as well. And this is what happened to Mary. She opened her right eye when Yeshua spoke to her, when he asked her this question. Ah, left eye, they're out of wine. Right eye, Yeshua is going to begin to reveal himself. This is wonderful. When you see with both eyes, you get perspective and you get depth. You see completely and you see the peripheral the way it should. And we need to learn to see out of our right eye as well as our left. We have to do this. And this is something we're capable of, but we have to develop it. It is a skill. So what we do is next time you meet a concern, a box with a question mark in it, you're immediately going to have a human reaction. Immediately, pop, it's there. You can't help it. It's there. But stop. Pause a second. And say, okay, Lord, what is this to you? I know what it is to me. What is this to you? What's your purpose here? And wait. Muzzle yourself. Okay? Wait, and let's see what God reveals about it. And you might be amazed as you begin to see the world in a whole new way and with depth. Because we are surrounded with a spiritual world. You know, God says the glory of the Lord fills the earth. You can't see it with your left eye. You have to see it with the eye of faith. You have to see it through spiritual eyes. His glory fills the whole earth. But we have to see it through spiritual eyes, not through physical. You understand? You get it a little bit? This is the hardest of the three lessons to get down. Yes, I see your hand up. Yeah, it says, now we see through a glass darkly. He's quoting some of the Hebrew writings. That's a term that's used often in Hebrew writings. And it's through a dark mirror. And what Paul says when he says, we see through a glass darkly, I think it's 1 Corinthians 13 where it's found. What he says, we see through a dim mirror. And in Jewish writings, that phrase is always used to refer to the physical world. We were having a conversation with Michael and Bethany. They're over for Erev Shabbat last night, and how we got on this. But Michael is in psychology and psychological counseling and working on his doctor's degree. And we were talking about the mind and the soul. And we got to talk about how the physical realm reflects the spiritual. And according to the sages, they say that if you look at the human body and how complex it is, think of the cells. Each cell in your body is as complex as all the organs in the body. And then you've got all these different systems that work and function together. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. We are utterly complex. They say, well, your human body is a physical reflection of the complexity and the harmony in your soul, your invisible soul. Think of the work cut out for a psychologist who's trying to understand the soul and how utterly complex it is, and the only map we have is the scriptures. And then the sages say, look at the complexity of the world. You've got all these different kinds of animals, from little tiny bugs all the way up to elephants, and you've got everything in between. You've got aquatic animals, land animals, flying animals, and trees, and look at all that complexity. They say that complex you see in this physical world is just a reflection of the complexity, the beauty, and the harmony in the spiritual world. We need to change the way we look. We tend to think this physical world is so beautiful and complex and wonderful. You explore it and never learn it all. It's just a reflection of something much grander, much more detailed and complex and beautiful. It's not like the spiritual world just simple and dumb and monolithic and bleh. It's multi-layered, multifaceted. And this is just a hint of what it's like. This is the dim mirror through which we see a reflection of the reality. But you know what? We're going to move. That clock is flying. So let's move on a bit more. And this is a very, very important lesson to all of us as we move on to this next section. Let's pick it up in verse 23. And now Adonai, the God of Israel, has driven out the Amorite before his people Israel. Yet you would possess it? Surely whatever your God Chemosh will let you possess, that you shall possess. And whichever people God has driven away before us, that land we shall possess. In other words, all right, let's put your God up against ours. In verse 25, and now are you any better than Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab? This is reference to next week's Torah portion, Balak. Did he pursue any grievance against Israel, or did he make any war against them? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and its suburbs and Aroer and its suburbs and in all the cities that are near Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them during that time? I have not sinned against you. But you do me wrong to make war against me. I think this goes back to lesson one. Why did Ammon wait until this point to rise up and try to take back land that they had not had for well over 300 years? Because I think they saw in Jephthah a weak opponent, that they really underestimated him. Verse 27, I am not sinned against you, but you do me wrong to make war against me. But Adonai, the judge, decided today between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. But the king of the children of Ammon did not heed the words of Jephthah, which he sent to him. Now look at this, verse 29. The spirit of Adonai was upon Jephthah. And he passed through the Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed through to the children of Ammon. Jephthah declared a vow to Adonai and said, if you will indeed deliver the children of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever emerges, that will emerge from the doors of my house toward me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, it shall belong to Adonai, and I shall offer it up as an elevation offering. Now, In our Torah portion, Numbers 21, the Israelites make a vow. God, if you'll deliver the Amorites into our hand, give us victory over them, then we will devote their cities to you. But Jephthah goes way beyond that. If you deliver them into my hand, then when I go home, whatever comes out of the door of my house, I'm going to give it as an elevation offering to you. Let's look at that. Here's what he says. Then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace, I will offer it up for an elevation offering. The word elevation offering is one word in Hebrew. It's the word olah. This is the phrase, v'hayal Adonai, and shall be the Lord's. There's that lamed again, which means to or toward, and there's yad heh vav heh, God's four-letter name. V'haya, and it shall be la Adonai, to the Lord, v'hayaliyatehu, and I will olah and olah, I will offer it up as an elevation offering. But there's a problem with this word. And this is the amazing thing. I keep saying Hebrew is the key to the scriptures. I'll say it to the day I die. Hebrew is the key to the scriptures. God had inspired, whoever wrote the book of Judges, inspired that person to misspell this word. The word olah is misspelled. It's got a letter vav there. It shouldn't be there. Now we know what's being said. It's an elevation offering. Because you see the same root right over here where it says, and I will offer up an offering up. An elevation offering is an offering up. But it's misspelled. When the word is spelled with a vav, it's a different word. It's the word avela, which means wrong. It's found, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 times in scriptures. Here are a couple examples. Know in your hearts you devised, there's the word, exact same word, but plural. You devise wrongs. Your hands deal out violence on earth. Malachi 2:6, the same word's found again. True instruction was in his mouth, and no wrong, there's the word again, was found on his lips. The writer of Judges realized what Jephthah did was wrong. He might be offering up to God, but it was dead wrong. Because if you read the rest of the story, Jephthah wins the battle. He goes home, and what walks out of his house? His daughter. This leads us to lesson number three. Lesson number three. Having God's Spirit move upon you is no guarantee against doing something terribly wrong. This is why we can see men who we know are filled with God's Spirit and accomplish amazing things for his kingdom turn around and do something so boneheaded and stupid and sinful and wrong. We can make this mistake of thinking, God's filled me with the Spirit, and it's true. And you're doing something wonderful in God's kingdom, and it's true. And it's at that point, your yetzer hara, your evil inclination, will raise its ugly head and suggest, you're on a roll, kiddo. Don't stop here. Let's do this too. And let's do this. And you know, and the things you've been saying are so true, then say this as well. Let's really wow the crowd. And before they know it, they've really put their foot in it. They've totally messed up. Because you're filled with the Spirit, self-control is still the name of the game. It's like Paul in 1 Corinthians 14. He's talking about in the assembly. People might have a word of prophecy or a tongue or interpretation and these different manifestations of the gifts. But he warns them, do it decently. Do it in order. Do it under control. He says, for the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. The prophet must still be in control of himself. Because when you're being moved by the Spirit, you're not protected from error. You can still just make an error just as easily, maybe even more easily. Because alongside being full of the Spirit, you can get full of yourself too. Here's another way to word this. It's a little crass, but I put it this way. So, you're filled with the Spirit? That's great. Now, don't be stupid. Okay? And I think one of the lessons we can take from this, or two of them, you know, there are times when God's going to move upon you to do something very special, wonderful. But don't think for a moment you can't still fall flat on your face right then and there. Second lesson from this is when you see men, maybe on TV or you go to a meeting or you're in a church or a synagogue, and God's moving upon a person and they're ministering, doing something wonderful, don't you dare think for a second that person is perfect and can't fall flat on their face or do something very stupid in the midst of what they're doing for God. Because Jephthah, the spirit of Adonai was on him and gave him victory. In the midst of all this, he makes this really boneheaded promise to God. And so that God gives him victory, in the middle of all the rejoicing, there's incredible grief because of the terrible vow he had made. Now, I want to tell you this. The question is always asked, does that mean that he actually sacrificed his daughter on an altar? No, he didn't. He didn't kill her. But he sacrificed all his future generations who would have come through her. See, the word Olah means to go up. It's the same word God uses with Abraham. Abraham, Abraham. And he says, Hineni, here I am. He says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and make him an Olah. It didn't say to sacrificing. Okay? That's a different word. It didn't say to slaughter him. Zebach, it didn't use that. Olah simply means to go up. Now, of course, Abraham interpreted that, oh, I've got to sacrifice him, so he goes up in smoke. That's how Abraham interpreted it, and God knew he would. And that was the test. God knew it was in Abraham's mind. But in God's mind, he never changed his mind. Abraham did take Isaac to the mountain, up to the mountain, put him in the altar, and in his heart, he was given up to the Lord. And he did give him up to the Lord. Didn't have to kill him, though. So Abraham came down a wiser man, realizing, oh, I did give my son up as an Olah, but I didn't have to slaughter him. I didn't have to cut him up. I didn't have to burn him. Didn't have to sacrifice him. And there are words for all these different things. God said an Olah, and I didn't make him an Olah. And so the sages tell us that Jephthah, he did not kill his daughter on an altar, but she lived in celibacy the rest of her life. She never married. And so her friends all came and grieved over her, because the highest honor in a young Jewish lady's life at this time is to become a wife and a mother, to carry on her father's name, her husband's name. And so all those future generations who would have come out of this daughter, they were gone. They were gone. Because of Jephthah's rash vow. He's full of the Spirit, but when we're full of the Spirit, we need to empty ourselves of us. And he didn't do that. He wasn't careful. He wasn't cautious. All right, Jim, you've had your hand up. Come in. I'm sure there is. Jim's question is there significance to the fact that his daughter spent a period of time in mourning, and her friends all gathered to her and mourned because the thing she was aspired to her whole life growing up was now being robbed from her. And I'm sure there is a significance. I need to go back and listen to the teaching I did on Judges, and I remember what it was. But yeah, I'm sure there is. So can you remember these lessons, these three lessons? That no matter what defeated enemy you think you've defeated, it'll come back again. It'll come back again in a rage. Don't be surprised. Just defeat it again. Okay? Keeps you in practice. Second, always ask the question, Maliv Alak, what is it to me? And God, what is it to you? Look at things through the physical, through your human reason. You can't help but do that. But look at things through God's viewpoint, which is always the viewpoint of absolute truth. And how do you see things through this viewpoint? Expand your view. Look at things from the viewpoint of eternity. And It'll help you be more happy. And then the third lesson, if you're filled with the Spirit, be all the more cautious, because you're just as prone, if not more so, to falling on your face. Being filled with the Spirit is no protection against sin. Okay? Yes, Rob. No, I'm so grateful to God. I've made rash vows in my life. Oh, geez, I was just so full of myself. And then God says, okay, that's what you want to do? All right. And then all of a sudden I start seeing the the consequences of that. I'm so grateful that in the Torah, once a year we're commanded to come together for Rosh Hashanah. And an ancient part of that's a gift from God, is the cancellation of vows, where we can come before God in repentance, and when we realize we've made a rash vow, a stupid vow, a destructive vow that we thought was a bright idea at the time, we can come before Him and be forgiven for that and be released from that. And that's what the service starts off with, the very first thing, when we've seen that. I'm trying to remember that a Nadilat, I can't remember it's just been around my mind, the name of the someone who remembers it, what we sing. Kol Nidre, that's it. The Kol Nidre, all vows. Now, it doesn't mean you can cancel your marriage vows and things like that. It's the wrong vows, the egotistical vows, the stupid vows you made, that it'd be better off you'd never made them. Those are the things we come before us once a year and think, oh, that one I'm letting go. Now, you're not released from the vows you made that were smart and wise and should have been. But the dumb ones, God gives us a reprieve. And that's a wonderful thing. Well, our time is gone, but Adam, I see your hand. We'll give you the last word and we'll close in prayer. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. Great point. Yeah. The Torah describes if a father hears his daughter make a rash vow, he can cancel it on her behalf. If he hears his wife make a rash vow, he can cancel it on her behalf. So what do? Well, we're the bridegroom of Messiah. We have a husband who can cancel it. And for our sakes, He can give us a reprieve from that. So thanks for bringing that up. So let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, thank You so much for Your blessings to us. Thank You for Your word. Thank You for the words of Your prophets. And I pray that as we look at the story of Jephthah, that we'll see ourselves there in all of our potential for good and all of our potential for failure. And make us wise. Help us to learn from His lessons, that we might walk in wisdom and in truth, see things from Your point of view. And Lord, that we might be used and filled with Your Spirit constantly, but Lord, always be on our guard, realizing being filled with Your Spirit is not insurance against sin, but we will be self-controlled. And Father, I pray that You would help us to be like Jephthah in being a mighty man, a mighty woman of valor, in spite of the fact that we're born into a world where there's sin in our lives. So make us the people You want us to be. We'll give You the praise for all of it. In Yeshua's precious name, amen.